Hey, police court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156. I'm a public defender. I'm here today representing Mr. Jay Hamburg. Mr. Hamburg is a home builder. A home builder who got behind paying his bills during one of the worst home building recessions in recent history. The Attorney General has not attempted to distinguish his situation from that addressed in Bemis Construction v. Dorland, where the United States Bankruptcy Court held that managing a failing business and scrambling to survive simply is not criminal behavior. State's failure to prove Mr. Hamburg intended to permanently deprive anyone of anything is the clearest injustice in this case and requires this court to remand for entry of a judgment of acquittal.
So does the federal bankruptcy court, is that precedent for the state of Colorado courts as to a criminal matter?
Your Honor, it is not binding precedent upon this court.
So that's the view of that bankruptcy judge?
Addressing a nearly identical situation, Your Honor, that is correct.
Thank you.
Because the sufficiency issue has been well briefed, I'm planning to focus my attention today on the state's repeatedly calling my client a liar and explaining to jurors that he was accusing other witnesses of lying.
Before you get there, Mr. Evans, if I can interrupt you, I think the toughest part of your argument on the intent issue is Carlson. It's a division of this court said a defendant possesses the requisite intent when he or she obtains a victim's money or other property in a manner inconsistent with the victim's use and benefit. So I fully understand your argument about where's the evidence of permanent deprivation here, and your colleague across the aisle there, I'm sure, will get those questions. But the Carlson definition is pretty broad. It does cite to a People versus Treat, a Supreme Court case. What do you do with that? If that's the definition, then it seems like that intent is arguably satisfied here.
Your Honor, I think it's important to recognize, and I'm correct in remembering that is a theft and misrepresentation case involving a car sale.
I believe that's right.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think that it's important to recognize that in the context of that case, the theft that happened there was the initial misrepresentation by which the property was obtained. Here, there's never been any argument that money was flowing to Mr. Hamburg through perfectly legitimate means. The notion was that this theft somehow occurred when he didn't put the money right where it was earmarked to go. And I think that although I have to agree that the language in Carlson is broad, that that language has to be read within the context of that case. And that here there is not nearly so clear of a point in time where a theft allegedly occurred.
Well, Mr. Evans, could I follow up with that?
Yes,
if your client holds this money in a trust, as it were, in order to pay the subcontractors, if he moves the money out of the trust or holds it in a manner inconsistent with the terms of the trust, does that establish intent in and of itself, an intent to permanently deprive?
Your Honor, no, I don't believe it does. I mean, even the prosecution's witnesses in this case acknowledged that the money coming to Mr. Hamburg from his various projects was going into one big pool, and then it was coming out of that pool to the subcontractors on the various projects. Now, arguably, under the trust fund statute, that's not how he should have been doing business, but our Supreme Court has acknowledged that just violating that mechanics lien statute does not amount to theft without proof of intent to permanently deprive, at least if that's how theft is charged.
And is there no evidence here that that he, at the time of the theft, is there evidence that at the time of the theft he intended to return the money when he took it and used it for his own use, he intended then to return it?
Your Honor, I think...
There is his testimony. Go ahead.
Right. That is his testimony. And I think it's very important to recognize here that there's never been any allegation in this case that Mr. Hamburg was taking Curtis Martin's money and buying a boat or going to Blackhawk or something like that. He was putting that money toward subcontractors on other projects that simply had older bills. So, it's not an issue of him... It's not that he was intending to return the money. He was just intending to pay all of the subcontractors when the money was available. And it's not that, you know, he took money away from something. He just, by the state's own allegation, used money which theoretically should have been earmarked for subcontractor A and used it to pay subcontractor B.
So robbing Peter to pay Paul idea would be the subs for this project would be paid from a later home building project or some other source. Is that how this?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the, I mean, I don't think it's any different than when a paycheck hits my account. I have a mortgage and I have two student loans and a car payment to make, and I pay whichever one of those is due first. That doesn't mean that I intend to never pay the people who are down the line.
But the money's yours. You're talking about money that is given to you as your wages, and you can do whatever you want with it, and you don't have to pay anybody with it, and you're not stealing from your mortgage company if you fail to do that. But if I give you money to pay my mortgage, and you take that money and you pay your mortgage, you have now taken my money, and you may say, well, I intended to pay you back, but under theft is an intention. Once the theft occurs, I mean, as soon as I give it to you and you use it for some other purpose, you've taken it. And then if you come back and you say, well, I was going to give it back to you, does that undo the theft that you originally did?
Your Honor, under the terms of the trust fund statute, you are absolutely right. I mean, that money should have gone to the subcontractors for which it was earmarked. And that's, I don't think there's ever been any question here that, you know, that he should have been doing that. But the important thing is that just violating that mechanics lien statute doesn't get you to a theft conviction unless you have the intent to permanently deprive. And in this case, that intent was proven by these purported lies that Mr. Hamburg was telling. And I think that that's why it is so important to recognize the third issue raised in the briefs here, that, you know, all of the proof of intent to permanently deprive here was completely dependent upon his credibility. And this was nothing more than a situation where the alleged victims in this case were saying, you stole money, and my client was saying, no, I wasn't trying to permanently deprive anyone of that money. I just had more urgent obligations. So this case depended entirely upon whether the jury believed that in his credibility. And that's why I think the third issue in this case is really so important here. When evaluating the claim of prosecutorial misconduct, and this court engages in a two-step analysis, first asking whether the comments were improper, and then whether they require reversal under the applicable standard of review. Here, the Attorney General has not argued that the comments were not improper, so unless this court has any questions about that first prong of the analysis, I believe that the only question here is whether they require reversal under a plain error standard of review. And plain error is about ensuring that the trial is fundamentally fair. Our Supreme Court has said, without mincing any words, in Wendt, that repeatedly calling a defendant a liar in a case that depends upon the defendant's credibility undoubtedly affects the jury's impartiality, which corrupts the fundamental fairness of the trial. And that's exactly what happened here. None of the essential facts of this case were disputed. And as we've discussed, Mr. Hamburg acknowledged all along that he still owed money to these subcontractors. And the state's only real evidence of intent were his purported lies. It was in that context where credibility was so key that the prosecutor stood up in this cross-examination and said, why did you lie to AMA Electric? Why did you lie to Mr. Chesley? Why did you lie to this witness? Why did you lie to the next witness? And that's precisely the message that is categorically improper under Domingo Gomez and Kreider. And the impact of that message was not limited to cross-examination. And the focus of closing argument was on Mr. Hamburg's credibility. Prosecutors started by emphasizing that all you need to really look at here is credibility. And then in both closing and rebuttal, brought the jury back to that same portion of cross-examination and even argued in rebuttal that that precise portion of cross-examination was what demonstrated intent to permanently deprive. So this is not a situation where we're dealing with comments or limited in number or isolated in impact. And this was the case, whether he intended to permanently deprive of the money.
Mr. Evans, I just want to clarify your argument. There's really two separate arguments on the misconduct, as I understand it. One is the use of the word lie along the lines you just said. And the other, if I understood your brief, was setting up this dichotomy. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you need to decide basically, did Mr. Hamburg lie or did these seven subcontractors lie? I mean, I'm paraphrasing, of course. But
right.
that's a separate argument that you're making. Do I understand that correctly or am I misunderstanding?
No, Your Honor, it is a separate argument, but the two need to be evaluated together. And I think that when you look at the prejudicial impact, you can't look at one or the other in isolation any more than you can look at those four questions in cross-examination in isolation from one another.
But there are, and I just want to make sure I'm analyzing it correctly myself. I mean, I understand they're related, but one is, you know, our Supreme Court says, you know, don't use the word lie. The other is essentially commenting on credibility of witnesses. That's kind of somewhat of a separate analysis, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The problem with cross-examination is the prosecutor was downright calling my client a liar, and that's obviously categorically improper. The closing argument really relates more to the Liggett case and it put him in the same position and painted him in the same bad light by saying, I mean, that either he was lying or the witness was lying. And, you know, that same sort of ignoring of any form of alternative explanation for evidentiary discrepancies.
Thank you.
I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
You may.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter.
Feel free to move that podium down. There's on the
I
right.
I never do a very good job of that. That's better?
Just want you to be comfortable.
I'm comfortable. Well, as comfortable as I can be standing up here. But I'd like to start off with the lying comments. What the prosecutor said and the questions the prosecutor asked were, well, were these witnesses lying when they testified? You said such and such. And the defendant responded either, I don't remember, I don't recall saying that. And I think that makes a distinguish there between the situation in what happened in Liggett, because the prosecutor wasn't really asking, didn't really elicit an answer that required the defendant to comment on the testimony of these witnesses. And I do think that is different because I don't think this case turned on credibility. I don't think it turned on what the defendant said to the subcontractors about why they had not been paid. To me, this case turned on the simple fact that the defendant asked or told the property owners that he needed certain amounts of money to pay specific invoices and sent them those invoices, and then he used the money for other things. And not just to pay other subcontractors, but for his own general, I'm sorry, I'm not feeling well today, his own general operating expenses, and that's what it turned on.
Well, sorry to interrupt. Do you think that it was proper for the prosecutor to conduct the cross-examination and make the closing remarks using the word lie?
I don't think that cross-examination was proper. No, Your Honor, I don't. But I don't think it constitutes plain error under the facts of this case. And the comment the prosecutor made during closing argument was either they lied, though all of those witnesses took the stand, raised their hands to tell the truth, and then they either lied or he didn't remember saying that. So the prosecutor wasn't saying the defendant lied or the witnesses lied. I think that's different. Either he didn't remember saying it or they lied. So she wasn't saying you have to believe one or the other. She wasn't making that clearly. She didn't refer to him as a liar. She just said either they lied or he didn't remember. which I think is slightly different.
Well, then, I'm sorry to interrupt again, because if we look at the plain error standard, what evidence of intent to permanently deprive, what was this case about?
To me, as soon as he is telling the property owners, and sending them invoices, I need this amount of money to pay these bills, and they promptly pay all the bills. And then he does not use it for those purposes and uses it for other purposes. Right there is where it begins.
Go ahead, I'm sorry, Judge.
Well, I just wanted to follow up with that. Is that an intent to permanently deprive? Is that evidence suggesting the permanent nature, the intent to permanently deprive that, or is that he's got bill problems?
I think a reasonable juror could conclude that that was the intent to permanently deprive. If someone says to me, I need this money, for your money for this purpose, and I turn it over to them for that purpose, and they do something else with it without letting me know, I do think it's happening right there. The fact that he might have thought that later on he would be able to repay this or cover this somehow else is not an excuse under the law.
I guess I'm still not understanding your argument, how that's an intent to permanently deprive. Let's take a hypothetical. Maybe you dispute these, maybe not. There was a lot of evidence here that Mr. Hamburg is talking to all these people. I'm going to work out. I'm going to get you paid. I'm going to get you paid. Now, you know, he told them things like, the owners never paid me, which wasn't true. But take the case that it's totally undisputed. From minute one, he's told everybody, I'm going to get you paid. How is that an intent to permanently deprive? Doesn't that suggest quite the opposite? His intent is to replenish this money as soon as he gets it.
That's what he's saying, but the fact that he thought he could repay it later, I don't think changes his intent when he took the money from them.
But his intent, it wasn't the evidence that his intent always was to repay. You know, it sounds like there was plenty of evidence this man's business was dying. He was desperate. Very much like the bankruptcy case, which I agree is not binding, but the facts are quite similar. He's desperate. And so I'm going to take this money. I'm going to pay the bills I need to stay. This is not like he took the money and went to, on a vacation, a lovely, Hawaiian vacation. He was paying his bills to keep his company afloat. And that seems to be, at least what I read in the briefs and the record that I read, that seemed to be undisputed, that evidence, that from the first minute he was trying to keep his company going and always intended to replenish it. That's what he told everybody, and I guess I'm trying to figure out what evidence to the contrary did he have. I'm concerned because what it sounds like you're saying is because he did it, that's the intent to permanently deprive, and that can't be enough.
Well, I think a part of it is, too, he's not just making misrepresentations to the subcontractors, and I do think that that's probative of the intent to permanently deprive. And some of those he didn't dispute in his own testimony. He said, yeah, I may have said that. That's what I meant when I said that. I do think that that's probative evidence. The problem is he's making misrepresentations to the property owners about what he is doing with the money at the time.
Well,
I think you could infer the intent from that as well.
Was there any evidence that he told the property owners about this and that he was going to give the money back to them?
Later on, after the property owners learned from various that the liens had been filed against their property, and they got one of the subcontractors called them in Florida and said defendant told us that you're having financial problems and you can't pay us, and we're a small operation, we really need this money. That's when the property owners realize, oh, all these people aren't getting paid. And then at various points he indicated he was going to attempt to pay them back, or he was going to pay them back, but he never did.
How would you define intent to permanently deprive?
Now, at the time of the taking, you don't intend to return the money, that you use it in a manner that's inconsistent with the person who owns that property, that money in this case,
following
the property inconsistent with their use, which is what he did.
So is every violation of the trust fund statute a crime?
I don't think so, but it wasn't an...
So when would it not be? If you take that money and you violate the trust fund statute, is the issue just at the timing? That I guess one scenario may be the money's in the trust fund and then you do something else versus from the first minute you expected to use it for something else. Is that the distinction you're making?
No, I just think it would just depend on the facts of each case. And we, as I said, we had a jury hear all these various arguments, and that was his defense here, was that, and he had an expert come in to say this is apparently common in the construction industry, that property owners pay for things and then the general uses the money for other purposes. And that was sort of the defense here, that there was nothing wrong with this behavior. But he, and I do think evidence came in where he had some money, of course, that could have gone to pay some of these subcontractors, but he used it for his own, not just to keep jobs going, but for his own personal expenses as well, so.
Now, that's not what Mr. Evans said. Mr. Evans, as I recall, argued that all of this money was used to pay subcontractors.
And this is my memory of this. As I recall, there was money he used to pay for company car, for operating expenses, electric bills, things like that, to keep his, where he was living and working out of, perhaps going. That it wasn't, that every dime wasn't going to pay subcontractors who were working on this property or other properties.
But some of it was paying off old subcontractor bills.
I believe so, but I don't recall amounts or percentages or anything like that, Your Honor.
So what about this argument then that by using this phrasing, lie, as I understand Mr. Evans' argument, it is that this really rested on the defendant's testimony that he intended to pay this money back. He did not intend to permanently deprive, and that the use of the word lie, which is categorically prohibited, goes to the very fundamental issue here as to whether to believe the defendant, and that it becomes plain error.
I don't think anything that the defendant said was truly, or his defense rested on anything that was truly contrary to anything the subcontractor said. I think the defendant acknowledged, and he said, I can't remember exactly what I said, acknowledged that he was putting off the subcontractors by making various statements. So it wasn't, there was not a dispute whether he told, really, whether he told the subcontractors a specific thing or not. So it didn't turn on that, because he acknowledged, and I believe at one point in closing argument, his attorney said, well, he was under a lot of stress and he was just trying to, you know, keep everybody happy. So I don't think this was one of those cases like Wend or Wilson where it all comes down to credibility and what somebody said and what somebody testified.
But of course, in Wend, the defendant's counsel admitted that the defendant had lied. And then the prosecution said that the defendant had lied. And the court said, even then, it's so egregious that it had to be reversed.
But that whole case turned on credibility. Wend, the only two people that were present when the victim died were Wend and the victim. And so Wend was the only person that could say for certain what happened during, I think she said she acted in self-defense. And so her credibility, everybody knew the victim was dead and that she had killed him, and the only thing was whether she had acted in self-defense. And that case entirely turned on her credibility. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the word lied was used 72 times or something like that in when. So. If this court has no further questions, I'd ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Van Horn. Mr. Evans.
I'd like to start by just clearing a couple of record issues. Judge Carparelli, you asked if there was any evidence that my client was talking to Mark Curtis and John Marring throughout the course of this about what was going on. I would direct you, Your Honor, to volume 12, pages 155 through 160. That's Mark Curtis's testimony. Also, People's Exhibit 27 and Defendant's Exhibit 105 and 106, I think all evidence that from day one, once these financial difficulties came to light, they were in communication the whole time.
Once they came to light. I mean, isn't that the same as, you know, a thief being told, you know, you stole my car, and at that point then he says, okay, let's talk about it? I mean, it would think that the question really is, was it without any inspiration where the person said to the homeowner, I'm trying to balance all of my books here, and I'm not going to be able to use all this money for your contractors. I assure you that when more money comes in, I'll get your contractors paid before there's an accusation.
Your Honor, I believe that these conversations started when Mark Curtis was contacted by Pella Windows. And, you know, unlike a situation where they called and said, somebody stole my car, it was Pella Windows calling and saying, I haven't been paid yet. I would like to be. And that's when these conversations started going. But once that happened, and there wasn't any question here about the facts. I mean, everybody understood what was happening. Additionally, Attorney General characterizes the questions during cross-examination as, were the witnesses lying? That's just simply not correct. I mean, the questions were you lying? Why did you lie? And that's clearly reflected in volume 14, pages 16 through, or excuse me, 61 through 62. Attempting to distinguish Wend and Wilson, regardless of the number of times the word lie was used in Wend and Wilson, I believe it was used 8 times. It was used 5 here. And Wilson is a case, another one, just like this, where one party is saying one thing, defendant is saying another thing. And this certainly does not turn on credibility any less than Wilson did, where the conduct was plain error as well. I see that I'm running out of time here. I just want to sum up by saying that Mr. Hamburg's not a thief. The evidence reflected nothing more and nothing less than the fact that in 2008 he couldn't pay his bills. In an attempt to turn that into criminal conduct, the state resorted to simple name calling and did so in a way that did corrupt the fundamental fairness of this trial. So I would respectfully ask this court to reverse his conviction and remand this case for either entry of a judgment of acquittal or a fair trial. Thank you for your time, Mr. Attorney.
Thank you, counsel. We accept this case as submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.